Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. This time, I'm joined by a repeat guest, Scott McNulty from The Incomparable, and we are going to be discussing Rainbow's End by Werner Vinge, which won the 2007 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Scott, thank you for coming back.
Thank you for having me back.
Yes.
It's always nice to be asked to return, because then you think, well, I guess I didn't screw it up too much.
Right. It's funny, because I actually re-listened to the Citeen episode a few days ago. And at the end of that, you're like, hey, if you want me to come back, you know, I have a novel in mind. And I said something like, yeah, sure. You know, once I burn through my list, maybe in about a year or so. And that was 2017. So
I wonder what the novel was that I had in mind.
Yeah, I was curious about that too. I didn't count on you to remember it just because it's 4 years.
It might be, in fact, the one that we're going to talk about, Rainbow's End. Because
One of the reasons that I didn't expect you to necessarily remember is your life has been eventful, particularly the last couple of years. But Why don't we, since you've been on before, we don't have to do the full recap of everything people need to know about you, but probably should talk about your podcasting. So how about talking about Random Trek and the Vulcan Hello?
Yes. So I specialize in Star Trek related podcasts, apparently. The podcast that I host most often is Random Trek, which is a podcast in which I discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. It is as simple as that. I recommend you listen to it. I'm biased, but I think it's pretty good. I also, with my pal Jason Snell, who is the kind of the head of the Incomparable Network, co-host a podcast called Vulcan Hello, which is about all of the new Star Trek that's coming out. So we covered the last season of Discovery. We talked about Picard, all that stuff. And nice. We'll be back for the new season and whatever else is coming out with Star Trek. And then we also have a Dungeons and Dragons podcast on The Incomparable called Total Party Kill. And I am a dungeon master for one of the games in there. Although, given my eventful life in the last couple of years, I haven't been DMing as much.
Right. And since our first episode on this podcast came out, I also appeared on Random Trek, and we talked about, I can't remember the name of the episode, but it was Star Trek Voyager, which was good because I haven't watched much of it.
It is always good to either I say, well, you know, I like talking about Star Trek with anybody, but my favorite conversations are kind of at the poles of Star Trek fandom. So either you haven't seen any Star Trek or any much of the series that we're going to talk about. And then, you know, there are lots of questions about, you know, whoever is this character? Is that person a robot? No, they're a Vulcan. And the other end is someone who, you know, is just deeply, deeply in love with Star Trek. And we can, you know, you can have interesting conversations with both. And that's also kind of the polls also help with episodes as well. So there are some really bad Star Trek episodes, and they're fun to talk about because they're awful. And then there are some masterpieces of science fiction storytelling, and they're great to talk about because they're great episodes. It's the ones in the middle that are just kind of bland Star Trek episodes, not so much fun.
Right. It's funny because that kind of translates to this podcast as well, because, you know, these are all winners of an award. And so there are going to be lots of people who like every title that we cover here. But, you know, it's also nice to a good percentage of my guests are, I want to talk about this book because I absolutely adore it. And then there's other ones where it's just, I've been wanting to read this one. It's on the list. So let's do it. But it's pretty rare that it's just, I didn't really like this one and I wanted to read it again.
You know? Make me read a book again that I did not like.
Yeah. So on that note, why this book?
So I am actually perhaps one of those people who says, make me read a book again that I did not like. So I have a very distinct memory of this book, the cover of this book, in fact, gracing a hardcover copy of this book that I purchased probably for what year is it now, 2021, 15 years ago. 14, 15 years ago when it first came out, because that would be the only reason I would have a hardcover of it. And I have distinct memories. So people listening to this podcast probably don't know much about my reading habits. one of the things that I read a lot, which I don't think is surprising for a guest on this show, right? I also invariably, nearly instantaneously after I finish a book, forget the contents of said book. Which, you know, maybe doesn't make me a perfect guest for this kind of podcast, but But I have a very clear memory of buying this book, of reading part of this book, and then stopping in disgust. But I don't remember why I stopped in disgust.
Okay.
And so I remember the point at which I stopped, which is involves vandalizing a car. I'm not sure if that's a spoiler, but it's a kind of a pivotal moment in the book. And I just stopped reading it. And I very rarely, Seth, I don't know about you, but I very, very rarely stop reading a book. Even if I'm not liking a book, I feel like I would need to finish it. And so this is one of those rare times when I just stopped reading.
Okay.
And never started
reading. That's a rare occurrence for me, I think. Other than I allow myself what I call a thumb through, where like I'm going to, especially that's more with nonfiction, where I'm just going to kind of browse through it, see how long the chapters are, see if the chapter titles look interesting. But with fiction, I usually, you know, it doesn't count until I'm past like 30 or 40 pages. And then at that point I can go, you know what? It's not working for me. I never started this one. It never happened.
I see. So you've got a Weasley way out.
I do. Yeah. And the other, the other thing is it's because I've been burned, right? Where I distinctly remember I was reading The Historian by Elizabeth Kostova. I think that's the name.
Oh, yes.
And it was late due back to the library because I just wasn't enjoying it. Mm-hmm. And I fell into the sunk cost fallacy of books, which like, hey, if I'm going to pay a fine for this, I'm going to finish the stupid book. Mm-hmm. And so I pressed on for a couple of days and I finished it. And I thought, that is a 250-page novel crammed into 700 pages. I should not have done that because it wasn't worth it. So ever since then, I've been like, you know what? If it's not working, just let it go.
Yeah. And I said it was a Weasley way out, but I do actually think it's a much better use of time to just give up on a book after 30 or 40 pages. Because if it's not going to get you within 40 pages, even if it's like a 1,000-page book, you're not going to.
Yeah.
And one of the other books that I stopped reading, and this may be controversial, I don't know, because there are some people who really love this series, but the first in the Wheel of Time books, because everybody loves the Wheel of Time. Well, maybe not everybody, but there was a time when everyone was so crazy about it. And so I said, well, I got to read this book because I like fantasy. And this is a big, you know, honking fantasy book. I should read it. And I may be exaggerating here. So people who love Wheel of Time, please don't send me nasty emails. but I felt like the first like 100, I read like 120 pages and this, the main character was still like walking through his village. And I thought, not for me. And so I just stopped reading.
Sure. Well, I have that book and I have not started reading it. I've never read any of those books. So I'll put myself up on the stake with you and say, I'm just going to wait until I think there's a television series coming out.
Yes,
and I'll consume it that way. And that's fine with me.
Oh, so, boy. You're going to get so many angry emails.
I could be pilloried for that. long way of saying, this is a book that you had attempted once, but wanted to take another shot at.
Yes, because I have not, and this is another thing, I don't know if I should admit this or not, because sometimes I feel like, as someone who is in certain circles, I mean, generally, most people on this planet have no idea who I am, but in some circles, I am known for reading a lot of science fiction. And with that responsibility, in quotes, comes this weight of, well, there are some science fiction authors that you should really have read, because they've written important science fiction books, right? And I think Werner Vinge is one of those people. He wrote, now I'm blanking on the name of the book that he wrote, but it's he's an important...
Fire Upon the Deep?
Yes, Fire Upon the Deep is the book, like his seminal book, I think. Not that I know much about it, but I haven't read that book. I haven't read anything by him. And so I know for a fact, whenever I picked up this book 14 or 15 years ago, I thought, I've got to read something by this guy. And so I picked up this book and then I didn't like it. And I think one of the reasons I didn't like it... has to do with the book, but the other reason has to do with me. And that is, I was expecting kind of, you know, space opera, far flung in the future kind of stuff. Cause that's kind of what he is known for, or at least in my mind, what he was known for. Turns out he's written a bunch of these kinds of near future books as well. So he may just as well be known for them. But this is very much not that. It's kind of a near future, pretty, I think, plausible near future. So kudos on that, especially since I think he mentions Wuhan and pandemics very early on in the book.
Right.
I'm like, whoa, too close to reality.
Yeah.
And so this is, it's a mismatched expectations also had something to do with it. Cause I was thinking, especially if you look at the cover of the book, I feel like it's probably because there's the, what, I forget what they call it, but like the virtual world internet
right.
thing that everybody has. And so everyone can see, you know, wacky worlds around them. And so the cover, I'm sure, is playing off of that. But it certainly looks like it's a futuristic, far-flung thing. And it is right. not.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, even in some places when you see the title, it says Rainbow's End, a novel with 1 foot set in the future.
Mm-hmm. See,
so it tells you that it's not, you know, far future, like A Fire Upon the Deep or A Deepness in the Sky, which I haven't read A Fire Upon the Deep yet. It's actually on the schedule for later this year, but I did read A Deepness in the Sky, and I really enjoyed that one. So, and it's a very different book than this.
So. I can imagine. And I did not enjoy this book.
Okay. That's a good segue into kind of overall thoughts about this one.
So I will say that, this book made me want to read some of his other works. I haven't yet. I certainly want to read Fire Upon a Deep and, you know, that series because it kind of speaks to me and I think that he's a good writer. But then now I will get into the other problem I had with this book, which was, so I had mismatched expectations. And then reading it again, I realized, the main character, Robert, is unlikable.
Yes.
For the vast majority of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Like really unpleasant.
Yes. It's funny. You can have, to base a good character arc, you know, you want to start somebody someplace, but I feel like, you know, the meter was a little too far to one side to start that character off. Cause he's this, you know, crotchety old misanthrope basically. Mm-hmm. And you find out that's the way he's kind of always been.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an interesting story. So it's a really interesting story. And I generally, like, I don't have a problem with books that have characters who are awful. Even main characters are awful. I mean, it's a higher mark, like a higher bar to clear as an author, I feel like, to tell a compelling story with a main character who you are actively disliking as a reader. But I think it's doable. And I think that he almost succeeds with this book. But I feel like, oh man, he is Robert. I don't know how to say the last name correctly. So I don't want to. It's G-U, so make me say it's Gu. No, not Gu.
That's the way I've been saying it. If it had an N on the front of it, then it would be different. But
there you go. So his family, like it's kind of, it follows him and his family, and you know, there's a whole bunch of interesting stuff around the story and everything. But it's really a story of him coming to grips with the modern world. And I think it's really a story of kind of aging and losing certain skills, gaining other skills. You know, how do you deal with that? Can you be an unchanging person in a changing world? And the answer is no. And that's difficult. And
can you gracefully change with it?
Yes. And the answer is yes, but not if you're Robert. he apparently failed that part, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's very much a man out of time, but not as a result of like, I was thinking for comps, I was thinking like Buck Rogers, you know, where he gets frozen for 100 years and comes back and everything's different. Well, this guy was just locked in his mind with dementia for, I don't know, 20 years, something like that.
Yeah.
And so then he reemerges after this revitalization treatment and is a man out of time.
Yes. And I think part of the reason, so I like that I didn't stop reading the book, obviously, because I knew we were going to talk about it on the podcast and probably would ruin the episode if I stopped reading it. but also I'm older than I was when I read it the first time. And so I'm not that old, but I'm getting to the point where, you know, things are happening that, you know, I got to the point where I don't recognize the popular music that the kids are listening to. I don't really know much about TikTok. Like there's a whole culture of stuff that I'm not tapped into. Even when I was younger, I wasn't really tapped into the popular stuff, but at least I was conversant in it. Right. I am no longer fluent in pop culture is basically what it is. And I am now, you know, you get to the point in life where your pop culture knowledge just kind of fossilizes and you think, whatever I liked as a kid is what everyone likes, and we will just assume that forever. And so I've reached that point in my life, and I've also reached a point in my life where, and this is actually, I think, probably true as long as I have been alive. Like one of my greatest fears in life is developing dementia, because it just seems so awful. And it's difficult for, you know, everyone who loves you. And, you know, it's just horrific. And so this book kind of plays into both my feeling like I'm getting older and my own mortality, and then my fears of, oh goodness, if I, you know, who knows what could happen, and I could develop Alzheimer's, you never know. And that would be awful. And then, you know, the other thing is, and I think this is not a spoiler, I think they kind of talk about it, like he's a poet, and he kind of loses his muse or his gift, or at least he thinks he does. It's unclear if he actually has or not, but he is a harsh critic of both himself and everyone around him.
Especially everyone around him.
Yes. So it is unclear whether he's kind of, you know, and that's a whole nother conversation about, you know, creativity.
Well,
and,
I mean, we've kind of been dancing around what the plot of this is. So can you try and give a condensed version of it that's not too spoilery?
Yes. So this guy, Robert Gu, I guess is how we say it, he has been suffering from Alzheimer's for, as Seth said, like 20 years. It's unclear how long, but it has reached a point in medical technology where many new treatments are available, and they've gotten to a point, which is also another kind of plausible thing, I think, where the technology has gotten so good that it doesn't work. Like, they have solutions for problems that everyone faces but don't work for everyone. So based on like your own genetics, they might be able to fix Alzheimer's or some other genetic disease, but someone who's, you know, right next to you in the same ward has the same thing, but this cure won't work for them.
Right.
And so they can solve a bunch of things, but you just kind of have to be like, I forget what they call him. He's like a miracle man or something, because all of his diseases are ones that they can basically cure. So it works out well for
him.
And
turn him back into a 17-year-old.
Exactly. So not only is he, you know, back to, he doesn't have Alzheimer's anymore, excuse me. He is fit and hale and much younger looking than he has been for forever. So he's basically reborn, right, into this new world. And while he's been suffering from Alzheimer's for 20 years, the world has moved on. And so he doesn't, he feels like he's lost his mojo. He's a famous, super famous poet. Although, you know, in levels of fame, I feel like being a super famous poet is, you know, not, he thinks very highly of himself.
Yeah, he sure does.
Not to, you know, if any poets are listening, I value poetry. But I'm just saying in the grand scheme of things. And so he comes back, he feels like he can't write poetry anymore. And he also, apparently gains, a great skill at, mechanical things and technological things. Right. And so, which he's never really been good at,
He's almost been a technophobe up till then.
Exactly. So he kind of was actively resisting it, really. And so now he's got the skill that he doesn't really appreciate. He feels like he can't do the thing that he feels like he's been put on this planet to do. And he also has, you know, no one likes him because he's an awful person. So he is kind of cut off, although he is staying at his family with his family because, of course, you know, you still have family obligations. And his son doesn't really like him. But they put him up in their house because, you know, you got to. And then through trials and tribulations, he has to go to high school. He's mean to people at high school. He's mean to his granddaughter. He's mean to everybody he meets, really. And then through trials and tribulations of various happenstance and sentient AI question mark. He gets involved in machinations far beyond what he is, realizing, and gets kind of as a pawn in this power play between Indo-Asian and European intelligence agencies and American intelligence agencies, and this one guy who is trying to create like a mind control weapon, basically. And so he's using Robert and his other old friends I'm not really making it, it's much clearer in the book, but then there's a library involved and scanning.
I'm not totally sure I agree with you that it's much clearer in the book, honestly.
it is a little circuitous. Yeah. But through, so basically they get a chain of events so that these people will break into these biomechanical laboratories for an unrelated thing, but then he's going to use the first kind of nefarious weapon maker is using this as a cover to cover up his own project so that the other intelligence people won't find him.
Right.
And that's basically the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the carrot that's dangled in front of him is, hey, I can give you your news back.
Yes,
I can give
that's
you your
right.
Gift back.
This, yeah. This rabbit tells him that, and it's 100% true. A rabbit tells him that it can unlock this special treatment that can basically, I guess, resequence his DNA or something. I don't know. And give him back his poetic ability.
Mm-hmm. I didn't really give my kind of overall thoughts about this one. It's one of those where I feel like this is a pretty good book that I had a hard time connecting to. Mm-hmm. I had kind of a hard time following the plot. And so I've been reading plot synopses to fill in the
blanks. It's so straightforward.
Yeah. And so I'm hoping that during the conversation, you know, some things will come clear to me and I'll be like, okay, yeah, I like that. But I do feel like this is one that on a reread would be a lot clearer.
Yes. Since I have reread, maybe 100 pages or so, it is clearer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause it, you don't meet the main character. I guess you do meet him right away. It's just, there's a prologue first where you kind of introduce the overarching plot before you meet the main character.
It takes a long time to get back to that overarching plot, which was confusing to me when I first read it as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he doesn't, and this I don't mind as well, but when you're reading something, or when you're writing something, actually, I should say, I think as a science fiction author, you have to make a choice, or maybe not, but because I've not written any science fiction novels, but I feel like based on my reading, you make a choice. Am I going to handhold the reader basically and kind of lay out, you know, here's the world, here's the technology, and writers can do this in very good ways, and they can also do kind of info dumps, which are not so great. Mm-hmm. Or do I just assume that they're going to pick it up as they read and, you know, I'll just have the characters talk about the technologies and the world as it is in the book and not, you know, have a character say, you know, as you know, Bob, XYZ. And certainly in this book, there is no handholding. The prologue is confused me the first time I read it and the second time I read it because I was like, I'm not sure what's happening here. Mm-hmm. Who's talking to these people? Are these real? I don't understand.
Yeah.
And then it becomes clear as you're reading the book because then, you know, the whole, I'm just going to call it the internet, but it's not the internet. It's they call it something else, but it's a virtual reality belief circle thing that's an overlay over reality that is like internet plus plus.
Second Life. Kind of
exactly.
Thing.
Second Life, only people use it. Take that, Second Life. And I did find it amusing that, so you can interact with this Second Life in a variety of ways. Everybody, the cool kids use like retinal or like contact lenses, basically is what I thought of them as, and know, haptic feedback clothes, and you have to learn how to, you know, like twitch the right way. Mm-hmm. But you can also get like a lame tablet that you can use instead, which some of the characters do. And I just thought that was amusing because, of course, there will be different ways of interacting with this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the one guy with his ancient laptop. You
know, yes.
That he refuses. Somehow managed to stay state-of-the-art, I guess.
Yeah, so I feel like I get this sense that the character has just tinkered with it as much as possible to make it work.
I think so. It's a ship of Theseus, laptop of Theseus. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and other people are like using like smart paper.
Yes.
To kind of
Which is something interact. I want
smart paper. That would be cool. Let's talk, before we get into spoilers, let's talk about comps for this. I mentioned Buck Rogers. That's just kind of the man out of time thing where, you know, what it. It's standard practice in fiction to have a fish out of water character. And Robert is very much that when it comes to figuring out what the technology of the time is. And so that's kind of where the Buck Rogers thing comes from.
And the thing that pops into my mind, and this may not make a lot of sense on the surface,
okay.
But as I was reading this, so Robert is I think we can both agree, a deeply unpleasant character.
Yes.
And that made me think of another book that is kind of a classic of science fiction that also has a far worse character, to be honest, but also deeply, deeply unpleasant as the main character. The Star Is My Destination. I don't know if you've read that by Alfred Bester.
I have not finished it. That's one that I started and I haven't finished.
And basically the main character is an awful, awful criminal.
Okay.
I think, unless I'm mixing up my books, but I believe that's the one.
Oh, you're not thinking of The Demolished Man, are you?
I am thinking of The Demolished Man. There
yeah.
you go.
Yeah, yeah. So that makes
not,
more sense.
Not The Star Is My yeah. Destination. Mm-hmm. I knew I was thinking of something. That thank you for correcting.
Yeah.
So The Demolished Man, yes, that's what I was thinking of, which has a main character who is far worse.
Right, who wants to murder someone and get away with it.
Yes, and who has yeah. done awful things. Mm-hmm. To do this. And that's a good book that features yeah. a character who is awful.
I didn't even think of that. I mean, I have The Demolished Man down as a comp here as well, just because of the silent messaging, because it really reminds me of the, what's it called, Esper messaging, where it has the psychic people being able to communicate, you know, offline, asynchronously, kind of the way they do with the silent messages here, or Sming, I guess.
Yes. And that was the one that popped into my head.
Okay. The other thing I noted down here, and it's just more kind of a, if you're interested in stuff like, you know, haptic feedback and kind of immersive technology and its use, particularly in education, I would recommend Telepresence and Teleabsence by Michael A. Burstein. And those are short stories that are in his book, I Remember the Future. Highly recommended. So cool. How about we go straight into spoilers and then we can talk about whatever we want.
Okay.
I mean, as regards to this book, we can talk about it, whatever, too. But for the podcast, let's stick to the book.
No, I want to know what confusing parts you were hoping I might help you figure out.
Okay, I do have a list. So the rabbit.
Yes.
You mentioned that the rabbit makes the deal with Robert, but mm-hmm. I think it's the mysterious stranger.
But isn't the mysterious stranger the rabbit?
I believe so, yes. But it's like he has different aspects, like he manifests it to different people in different ways. Mm-hmm. Because the mysterious stranger kind of takes over...
the grad student.
What's his name? Zulfikar Sharif.
Yes.
The guy from Oregon State, which, you know, I'm in Oregon. My dad went to Oregon State, so...
Oh, there you go.
So, yeah, he kind of gets hijacked by at least two groups of people.
Yes.
And one of the groups of people is this mysterious stranger who I think we're led to believe, like you said earlier, is probably an AI.
Yes.
And Werner Vinge is very much, you know, I think he's credited with inventing the... or coining the term, the singularity.
Singularity,
the technological singularity. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting because he doesn't make the singularity a world-ending event. It's like this is somewhere at the beginning where you could end up with a Terminator kind of scenario, but it's at this point, it's like the AI is just playing around.
Well, it's I get the sense that it's kind of a newborn AI and it's just trying to, yeah. It's much like kind of Robert. It's very impressed with itself and, yes. but also not as unpleasant as Robert. Maybe right. because it's Bugs Bunny, basically. I don't know if he ever says it, but there are strong hints that it looks like Bugs Bunny.
Yeah. Okay. So the other thing is the book starts with a prologue about the whole honeyed nougat ad.
Yes.
And the fact that there was a virus, like an engineered virus mm-hmm. that made people suggestible.
Yes.
And I guess the honeyed nougat ad was almost smokescreen, right? Where they played that ad and then people wanted the honeyed nougat stuff, which I presume is a candy bar or something. But the virus itself was actually what was causing that, not the actual ad, right?
I think the ad was the virus. So what I thought it was, like it was interlaid in the virus, like it's suggestive of, and that made me think of the Neal Stephenson book that had his most famous book, maybe not.
Well, Snow Crash?
Presumptive, but his first book. Snow Crash, there you go. Yes, that's, that has a kind of a virus in it that spreads by like a mind virus. And that's kind of how I read the advertisement, basically. Mm-hmm. Seeing the advertisement infects you, and then, you know, a delayed reaction, you buy.
Right, but there was something additional in there where – They tested it by playing any ad for anything. And
you're
people
right.
who tested, who had the antibody for an actual virus, I can't remember what they called it, were it showed a marked increase in buying the honeyed nougat stuff.
See, now you are helping to correct my misconception, because I think you're okay. Right. Because that the whole plot of it is they want to break into this bio lab. So clearly there's a biological component of it. So it is an ad. And maybe the ad, it is a two-component thing, right? It has, you have to be infected with the virus, and then there's a trigger, like an external trigger that then makes you do something.
Yeah. So then the whole plot, right? And this is the other part that I wasn't totally sure. Was the virus engineered by this Alfred Vaz?
Yes. So Alfred Vaz is the, Indo-Asian intelligence guy. Right. And he has this kind of skunk works within an American biochemical company or something, it seems, to create this virus to give his country or alliance an edge over the Americans.
Okay. And to basically be able to turn everybody into drones if they want to.
Yes, just to have the option.
Well, this is where the Borg comes from.
Exactly.
And so then he kind of pulls all the strings using Rabbit, though he's also being used by Rabbit.
Yes.
To cause this this riot at the library at UCSD, right?
Yes, I both appreciate as kind of a clever thing that Werner has done here. I'll call him Werner. We're on first name basis. Because the intelligence guy is involved with lots of plots, and so you think I would imagine if you're someone who is like an intelligence, like the head of head of a secret department within a secret intelligence agency, like double secret, that you are always thinking of plots within plots within plots, and so I appreciate that this person has created this kind of ridiculously complicated plot to cover up his other plot. As a reader, you kind of feel like really this is a bit much, but I also think that Rabbit is also pumping it up too, because he is playing around with this stuff, so he's having fun doing this.
Yeah, I did kind of enjoy, this is more of the man out of time thing, right? Where Robert is very much, I don't like these darn computers, these kids should get off my lawn, yelling at Cloud, and when he finds out that the library at UCSD is being digitized, and in order to do that, these machines are going through and grabbing the books and cutting them off their spines and destructively digitizing them and then rebuilding them digitally. And of course he's horrified by this. And that's part of the riot, right? There's people out there with chants, we want our physical books. So that was interesting.
Yes. And so then he and his friends, so he has a bunch of kind of revivified to varying degrees colleagues/friends. They're not really friends because he doesn't have friends because he's awful. Right. they're acquaintances.
Can't emphasize that enough. He's terrible.
He's a bad person. Kind of band together because they want to save the books, and they're all, the thinking is they're all old people and they're the only people who appreciate books except for the librarian, who is younger and wears t-shirts that can change, like display t-shirts, which I thought was a nice touch.
Right.
And so they want to band together to stop this project, and they figure out, we don't really need to stop the project. We just need to delay the project because the tech company that's behind it doesn't have enough funding, and they really need this to work quickly so that they can get other contracts. And if it doesn't, it'll implode. And then the libraries of the world will opt to use a Chinese competitor's technology that is non-destructive. And so Rabbit somehow knows about this because it's an AI, and I guess it knows everything, and kind of basically worms its way into that group and gives them access to a bunch of stuff that they never would be able to get access to themselves. And they don't really, and this is another thing that I kind of bought, because all the people, including Robert, that are in this plot are all super smart people in certain areas, even if their knowledge is out of date. And I work in academia when I have in my full-time job. And so I am surrounded by super smart people who are super smart in a certain area. Like they know everything. World experts in certain areas. And sometimes, I'm not going to say 100% of the time, but sometimes when you are a world expert in one certain area, you tend to think that you are then an expert in everything, and your knowledge transfers to any other area of life.
Right.
And so the characters, I feel like in this book, kind of fall into that trap of, well, we're smart people, so this is easy for us because we're super smart, when in fact it is easy for them because they are being manipulated by kind of two other entities that they don't even know about, that give them access to like this glue that hasn't been invented yet, but is suddenly invented and breaking through security systems that they have no idea how they even work. So, I mean, there are lots of parts of this book that I enjoy. I'm not sure if altogether it is enjoyable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, another kind of book that this reminds me of in some ways is The Diamond Age, where, is that Stevenson?
Yes.
Yeah. Where like he just decided, you know what? I know all the things we could use nanotechnology for it. So I'm going to throw all of it at the wall and see what sticks. Mm-hmm. And here you have some of that as well, because you have the notion of the just-in-time training stuff, where you have the one character who lapses into Mandarin sometimes and uncontrollably because he got this training. Because I think he was in the military.
Yes, that is the implication.
Mm-hmm. And then Robert's daughter-in-law also gets this. And some people can take more of it than others, but it's kind of, there's an inevitable paying of the piper that has to happen where bad things can happen. And I thought that was an interesting thing. I just wasn't sure why it needed to be in this book.
Yeah, and it's another thing where it's like another opportunity for us to not like Robert, because this woman is... like she is legitimate. Like she does, she seems very nice. She's she works for her country. She goes through all of this JIT training like over and over again. Very dangerous. She's nice to her daughter. She's nice to her husband. She even puts up with her father-in-law, who's awful. Mm-hmm. And then how does he repay her? By sneaking a device into their house that then basically kind of like gets a sample of her or something, and then allows Alfred and Rabbit to create like a pattern of flashing lights or something that fries her brain, basically.
Yeah, to put her on the blink. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is awful. Mm-hmm. And then Robert feels kind of bad about it.
He does. And, you know, I don't want to say that there was no character development here, because he does have a little bit of an arc. But one major problem I have is, like, it walks him right up to the edge of being a better person. Mm-hmm. And then right at the end, because essentially he's had to come to grips with the idea that the promise that was made to me for getting my muse back, that's not important anymore to get my muse back, because, you know, he's connected a little more with his granddaughter.
Right.
But then right at the very end, the book literally ends with him going, what if I can have it?
And, I know.
That's just, you like, you reversed like from two paragraphs ago. If you had stopped it there, then he's in a good spot. But
yeah, he does come almost to the realization that maybe he doesn't have to be the same person that he always was. And maybe, his talent is not as important as relationships and his family and all these other things. And then he's like, on second thought, that'd be nice.
It sure would. Yeah. Even though, you know, what place is there? I mean, it does talk about, I was saying, what place is there in this society, the way media is created now, what place is there for this, this amazing poetry in this way with words. And it does kind of talk about how that's something that's perhaps missing in this generation that has grown up with all the wearable tech and the augmented reality and that kind of stuff, where they can create amazing things with gestures that they're doing, and they have great command of it. But, you know, there's no art to it.
Right. And we're kind of getting, that's basically Robert's opinion of it, though. So I feel like it's kind of filtered through his lens of, you know, you get the sense that he thinks anything that isn't poetry, and specifically anything that's not his poetry, is not really art.
Yeah, he's taking the Martin Scorsese view of the Marvel films.
You know? Exactly. Because you do get, I mean, the whole belief circle thing and the fight over the library, and then, you know, of who, what belief circle is going to be. I was kind of confused about why the university.
I was extremely confused. Yeah. Was the Scoochies and the Hasakians.
Yes. Why they were fighting and how this could, because I work at a university, and that's not really how they would, but maybe the near future, they will just let fans fight over who will basically theme the library.
Right. Yeah. Well, and then the library had to make a choice because it's got some kind of emergent personality.
Well, I felt like that was the rabbit who was kind of moving along the, because he wants to have a big crescendo. And so he actually, which was a very interesting and well-written scene, basically has the library walk, which was
that was cool.
Vivid. And then the, you know, Robert's son-in-law, who also happens to be like the officer of the watch and has, you know, command over many fantastic weapons and things, has to save the day by, you know, using fancy-dancy nanotechnology weapons to shoot at the library and shore up the walls,
Right.
which I liked. But that is also almost
kills his daughter, right?
Which is bad, yes. And that's also, to your point earlier, of what else can I throw into this book?
Yes.
Like everything. It's all in.
Yes, literally everything. And that's where you get the military essentially coming in to stop this, what's going on, the espionage essentially that's going on in the biotech labs. Mm-hmm. And the plan starts to fall apart. And Alfred says, well, we need to cut off the, you know, network access, because that's another thing, right? In society that's as connected as this, there's virtually no privacy.
Right.
Because everything's trackable by, I think he mentions Homeland Security, you know, 100 times in this book.
he does.
And so, you know, and yet the mysterious stranger / the rabbit is along with him and says, don't cut that off. Don't, you know, and they cut it off. And then this PDF shows up that I think Miri accesses, and it says,
yes,
how to survive and prosper in the next 30 minutes. PDF and the dedication to the idiots among you who cut the fiber link.
Yeah, I did like that a lot. I do like the character of the rabbit.
I do too. Yeah.
And the PDF was a great touch. Cause you get the sense that, you know, he has, whatever, like 3 seconds or less than that to basically think of an idea and shoot this, primitive digital artifact to, his compatriots to steer them in the right way. So I enjoyed that.
Yeah. And I think in a way, I think a better way to enjoy this book would be to see the rabbit as the main character, because it's a more enjoyable character.
He is far more, or they is a far more enjoyable character than Robert is. And interesting, right? It's a similar kind of character, right? They have like they're both new, basically newborns in this world.
Right.
Who have a bunch of kind of access to a bunch of knowledge and don't really know how to use it appropriately. And so they're kind of flailing about, basically. And so that's interesting, but I do think he focused on the wrong character because, Robert is just so unpleasant.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I did like Miri.
Yes.
You know, the fact that she was still doing her best to be a good granddaughter to this dick of a grandfather.
He is very mean to her.
Yeah.
And just because he wants to feel like he's one of these people who enjoys cutting other people down. And, you know, the bigger the person is, the more he enjoyed doing it in his previous life. But you also kind of get the sense that he was one of these people who just abused like the grad students that worked for him because he could, and he got off on it. And so, but now he has no kind of sway over anyone except for this one grad student from Oregon State who is kind of trying to use him to get a dissertation, but then is kind of, as we mentioned earlier, subverted by like everybody because he's not very good at using his own technology. But anyway, and so Robert turns his attention to his poor little, perhaps, you know, I don't want to say pushy, but bossy is worse than pushy because she is determined. That is what she is.
Assertive. How about
assertive?
That?
Yes, she is assertive. Like she knows. And basically, she does know what's best for Robert throughout the book, and he does not appreciate her help and is just really awful to her. And yet she continues to try to help him because she loves him, even though nobody else does.
Right. And, he does kind of save her life, and so
that's good.
You know, at some cost, you know, he does lose an arm in the deal.
Yeah, and that was, I think, an effective scene, and which is undercut by the last couple of lines of the book,
but
because he does basically like they're in where they end up in, it doesn't really matter where they end up, they're like in a lab and there's a fire and stuff is melting and coming towards her and she's unconscious and he's nearly unconscious and he moves his arm to shield her from whatever the rock or plastic,
it's essentially lava at that point, right?
Yes. which is, you know, powerful. And you think, oh, Robert is an awful character. But now finally, he's realizing that there are things that are more important than himself. And so that's it's a good moment that sadly is undercut by later developments.
Yeah. Now, we didn't really talk about, you know, going back to Sharif being hijacked by multiple groups. The other group that hijacks him is kind of led by Robert's ex-wife, I think.
I get the sense that it is Miri who has kind of cajoled everyone else to hijack him. So it includes Robert's ex-wife, another kind of, I don't remember what they call them, but another elderly person who has had her ails fixed, but is still trying to figure out the way of the world, but who has also, by the way, invented the secure layer of software that everything runs on in this world. And what is his name? What is his name? The Juan, who is he's in Robert's like shop class and whatever searching class. I forget what they call it. So she, I feel like Miri has cajoled them all to try to help Robert, and they decide to root this poor grad student because he's very trusting.
Rainbow's End, the name of the book. I have to admit that, you know, any time I've put this out on the website or on social media, I've put an apostrophe in there because I just assumed there was an apostrophe in there. And I didn't notice it until the book just straight out called out that there was no apostrophe. and there was it kind of pondering, is that a mistake, or they making a point about the fact that rainbows do end? And so I'm not sure what the name of the book means other than it's a retirement home or something, right?
Yes, I feel like it means, you know, retirement home is another thing that nobody wants to end up in, even though Rainbow's End seems like a nice retirement home. I have had to deal with retirement homes and kind of nursing homes, and they're not the best places to be. And it's kind of like a, it can be. I mean, I don't want anyone who is runs a nursing home to send me an angry email, but it can be a sad way to end your life. And so, you know, if you see, if your life is a rainbow, the nursing home would be the end of it.
Right.
And not a pleasant way.
I actually Googled Rainbow's End at some point today, and, you know, Google will often kind of promote in the order of things that are sent to you, local links. And it turns out that just down the road in Forest Grove, which is just the next city over from where I live, there's a Rainbow's End retirement home. So I thought that was funny.
It just seems like a bad name for, although I guess at the rainbow, I think you could also say, well, at the end of the rainbow is, you know, treasure and happiness, because that's where the leprechauns are.
So but see, that would be with the apostrophe though, right?
That's true. You've given me much to think about. That's an important apostrophe. It does change a lot.
I'm pretty sure I've actually sung at that retirement home, because I sing with a caroling group at Christmas time, and I don't think it was named that when we went there before. So I'm curious if there's a fan of this book there.
There could be.
I think I've pretty much come to the end of my notes.
I do think, so I like that he shouts out Terry Pratchett. So,
yes.
That's good. And I think the knowledge belief circle feels like it's kind of based on Terry Pratchett, Jersey.
Oh, the dangerous knowledge?
Heck, yeah.
Yeah. But that was the Hasekians, right? Kind of a made up different Terry Pratchett.
Exactly. Because I'm sure he didn't want to deal with Terry Pratchett's estate. Although Terry Pratchett was alive then, so dealing with Terry Pratchett. Right.
Yeah. And one of the things that this book does is it kind of, it reminds me of Demolished Man, The Demolition Man. The movie where, you know, all restaurants are now Taco Bell, where it has some mergers of corporations that it proposes. For instance, the mail delivery system is just called UPX.
Yes.
Or UPX or something. And then there's a media conglomerate called Spielberg Rolling, which I feel like Spielberg will have a lasting impact, but J.K. Rowling has not been super popular in the last few years.
So. Yes, it's some problematic aspects of that.
Yeah.
But not at the time this was written.
Not at the time this was written, yeah. One other funny thing that I thought was interesting was at some point in the background, there's a game of soccer being played, but they call it Egon Soccer. And at some point it says there was a near certain goal with a score of 0.97. Which is Schrodinger's athletics, I guess.
Yeah.
So, but that's another, just one of those kind of random things that he throws into this.
Yeah, you get the sense that he had a lot of ideas that he was excited about, and he sat down. I think he probably, well, I don't know how he wrote this book, but if I had to guess, he sat down and thought, well, what is the world going to be like in 50 years or 40 years? I don't even know what the date that this was set, but sometime in the near future, where are we going? He came up with a bunch of very amusing things that he thought of, plus some very plausible things. I don't want to kind of shortchange it, because I do think it's a very plausible future that he is created.
Yes.
And it feels authentic and believable. And so kudos. And that's difficult to do. I feel like it's easier, maybe not easier, but it's harder to do near future stuff just because it's so close to what we know. So if it rings false, you know, quickly, right? It's like the uncanny valley stuff, right? It's hard to do human motion because we're humans and we know what it looks supposed to look like at an innate level. But if you're doing, like, you know, 3,000 years in the future, you can create all kinds of wacky stuff. And like, well, it's 3,000 years in the future. Come on.
Well, that's, you know, you go back to some of the golden age science fiction too, that predicted, you know, 50 years of advances, right? And would have intercity rockets, you know, but no wireless communication of any kind, or wireless surveillance, satellite imagery, anything like that. And so, you know, you can get a lot of swing and miss in science fiction, depending on how far you're trying to guess.
Yeah. Well, you look at Star Trek, the original series, they have guessed many things, but yet they still have diskettes that they take out and walk to different parts of the ship and put in to transfer information.
Yeah.
Which was at the time still kind of a mind-blowing thing, but not so mind-blowing now.
True.
Or maybe mind-blowing in that kids today don't even know that that was something that you had to do.
Right. Definitely. Kind of moving towards final thoughts here. This is definitely not my favorite Werner Vinge book that I've read, and I've only read two. So, but I liked Deepness in the Sky quite a lot. So, even though it was a much longer book than this, and so I will say, this book not super long, so that's great. I went ahead and bought the audiobook so I could listen to portions of it as well, and so I might give that another listen and see if some of the flow of the book goes in a little better on a quote reread.
Well, this is my favorite book that I've read for your podcast.
Okay, you liked it better than Citeen.
I did. It is much shorter than Citeen, which is, you know, I like long books. But I also thought that it engaged me, even though I did not like Robert. I think that everything else in this book drew me to it, and Robert, the character, repelled me. And he is such a repellent character that I think overall it made me lukewarm on the book. But I think if you kind of removed him or your idea, which I really like, shift the main character to Rabbit, and you have a really good book. But that's not the book that we have, so I can't.
No, it's not.
I can't judge that book on a book I wanted it to be.
I'm curious. I mean, because every time I do this, I go back through the list and try and see where does this one fit in my ranking. But I mean, Citeen is pretty far down, I have to admit. even though, I mean, that was an experience, and you know, it's something we'll always have, Scott.
Yes, that's right. So. I feel like I don't have a good track record on your podcast here.
Well, I would say I'll have you back in a year, but you know, my track record for that isn't that great.
4 years from now, I will be back picking a book that you don't like.
Right. Well, it will probably have to be one of the actual nominees by that point, because I will have caught up. So.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to know. And you can cut this out of your podcast if you don't want people to know. But I am interested to know what your favorite book that you've read so far for this podcast is.
Favorite new book that I've read is probably Hyperion, just because I'd never read it before. And I thought that one was fantastic.
Such a good book.
I also just recently re-listened to Say Nothing of the Dog, which is a very different book than everything else on the list that I've read. And that one I just absolutely adore, in a very niche kind of science fiction, where it's science fiction crossed with Victorian novel of manners or a comedy of manners. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I mean, there's some old favorites in there too, like Dune and Speaker for the Dead that I love both of those. Though Dune was one of those ones that if I applied my standard to, I probably would have never gotten through. It took me 3 tries with Dune. So I will do the retry.
Oh man. Dune and Hyperion are both books that are part of series. There are many people who strongly suggest this. I don't know if I would strongly suggest it, but they're kind of the high points of the series. And if you stop at the first, it's not bad, but you can continue reading. And I don't think – I'm not one of these people. There are some people who think that you can – your pleasure or enjoyment of something can be retroactively ruined by the later books in the series, and I don't. Sure. I'm not one of those people, but if you are one of those people, and I do kind of get it, you may want to just stop at those first two.
Yeah. I have experienced that. I'm more with movies, like when I watched the first of the Hobbit movies, it made me think less of the Lord of the Rings movies. And so I thought, I'm not watching any more of those. I still like the Lord of the Rings ones, and I'll keep that intact by
contain the damage.
Yeah.
Hyperion may be one of my favorite books, period. So good.
But it just kind of ends. I want to know what happens next.
I like books that just got to end.
Okay.
I'm an enigma.
Yeah. I'm on record on my other podcast as I like the downer ending, where I like the one where it's a robot uprising and humanity loses, because of course we would lose.
It's true. We're all.
If the downer ending makes sense, I'm all for it. So. Okay. Well, I think that will suffice for final thoughts. On this book. So Scott, I want to thank you for coming back on the show.
Thank you for having me. And I look forward to making you read another book that you don't really like.
We'll see. But before we sign off, where can people find you?
Probably the most likely place to find me is on Twitter. I am Blank Baby on Twitter.
Okay. Perfect. I'll put that in the show notes. And I always enjoy when a new random track shows up in my podcast player, and the Vulcan Hello as well. That's always fun, because I actually, since our last recording, I've actually caught up on the new Trek stuff, although I haven't watched Lower Decks yet.
Oh, you should watch Lower Decks.
Yeah. I'll probably do it at some point. All right. Well, in another 4 years, who knows, we can talk about a nominee or something. I'm not sure what I'm going to do by that point, but it's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you again.
Yep. Okay. Bye. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Scott. It's always nice to talk to him. Make sure to check out his links. I'll put those in the show notes. Check out The Incomparable. Random Trek is great. The Vulcan Hollow is a lot of fun. Scott and Jason have a great chemistry, so always fun to listen to them break down the new Star Trek. I do want to let you know that my schedule is starting to get kind of busy with work and other things, and so I'm probably going to have to slow down on the Comfort Reads episodes. I've run out of guests that I definitely had scheduled for one of those. I have some others where I've got lines out there, and there's been kind of I'd like to do one at some point, but we haven't settled on a title yet, and I might have to delay some of those. So keep watching the feed. They'll just show up there when I do them. They tend to be lower homework episodes, just because I usually use audio for those. So if I can do them, I will, but probably not super consistently. Of course, if you would like to support the show in any way, you can follow on social media at Hugo's Podcast if you don't already. If you want to say hello in another way, you can shoot me an email, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or fill out the contact form on the website. If you want to leave a review, that'd be great. Share it with your friends, retweet, that kind of stuff. That's fantastic. If you'd like to sign up to be a patron of the show and my other podcasting, you can go to patreon.com/hugospodcast and sign up there. I'd appreciate that. And before I sign off, I want to put in a plug again for Zencastr. It's a great tool if you're an aspiring podcaster. It's something that's really, really nice for if you're like me and you're normally recording with somebody who's not in the same room as you are, especially if it's somebody who's not maybe a podcaster. It breaks down the barrier to entry, just because you send them a link and it shows up in their browser and records their track and uploads both of them for easy editing. So really nice tool. I use it at the hobbyist level, so I don't pay anything for it, but I figure the least I can do is get the word out there on a really cool tool. Okay, so that'll about do it for this time. So I will talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Who Goes There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.